Well, welcome everybody on behalf of Eversheds. Delighted to see so many people here. And I'm not going to speak for very long, but this is quite a difficult subject, and usually it's helpful if there's some kind of framework in which to think about it and to sort of get some idea of what the really important legal issues are. So what I'm going to cover is how you get out of the EU and what's involved in that. I think many people will know something about that. And there are some quite important aspects to that, particularly what kind of agreement we can hope to get as a matter of EU law. What is the UK looking for from the EU to the extent that we know that? Because Mrs. May has said we're not having a running commentary on the negotiations, but she has nevertheless, for those people who really have been studying what Brexit might mean, she has, I think, said enough to let us all know some really, really key points about Brexit. There are some quite difficult issues about trade and about whether or not there will be a free trade relationship between the UK and the rest of the EU. And I'm going to say a few words about where we might find ourselves if, and this is my expectation, there is no immediate free trade agreement with the rest of the EU. And then I'm going to say something about what's going to happen to EU law. And a few words about Brexit and devolution, in which I am not an expert and which I will be deferring to, particularly to Joe and to others here today. So starting then with how you get out of the EU, the referendum result doesn't trigger what's called Article 50, which explains what you have to do if you want to leave. Basically, if you want to leave, the member state wanting to leave must take a decision to leave the EU in accordance with its own constitutional requirements. And for the man in the street, that would sound like it's a fairly simple thing. You know, we've got a constitution, people must know what that means, but you would be wrong. And as a result of that, there are a number of actions going through the courts now to determine whether or not the decision to leave is an act of what's called the royal prerogative, which means that the Prime Minister says, I'm giving the notice to the European Council, or do you actually have to have an act of Parliament that says it's been decided that we're going to leave? Because European community law actually is a product of international treaties. And if you're asking me for my opinion on this, my opinion is it's very likely that it's going to be a question of the royal prerogative, because the treaty-making power is about the royal prerogative. It is not about Parliament in the United Kingdom. However, Parliament did have to pass the European Communities Act 1972. The reason it had to do that was that international law doesn't just come straight into our legal order. Something has to happen to make that possible, and that something is an act of Parliament. And so the arguments in these actions are that actually by introducing an act of Parliament in order to introduce European Community treaty law into our legal order, the royal prerogative, if you like, was suspended or abrogated in favour of Parliament. And so those are the disputes that are going through the courts right now. And it's my expectation, I think there's going to be a hearing very shortly, actually. It's the middle of October, the first hearing. There will be an expedited process for these cases to make sure that any appeals that can be brought against whatever decision is initially taken can be heard, and that actually explains quite a lot about the timing that Mrs. May explained at the Conservative Party conference about the giving of the notice to leave. So when do we actually leave? Once the notice has been given, assuming someone can sort out how you do that, whether you need an Act of Parliament for it or whether the Prime Minister does it exercising the royal prerogative, once we've worked that out, it's going to be 2 years after the notification has been given to the European Council, unless it is unanimous between all the members of the Council, that's all the Member States, and the United Kingdom, that period should be extended. And I think if you were a betting person, you would not bet on any extension. And that means that the way this article works is that you know, it's not a great place to be, actually, however well you dress it up. When you know that a deadline is approaching you, you give the notice, you don't know what the negotiations, how they're going to go, but the deadline is approaching you when you are going to be leaving whatever you have agreed, even if you haven't agreed very much. So actually this is a difficult situation, and arguably therefore it's better to have a bit more time in which to think about how to position those negotiations. So what's actually going to be agreed under Article 50? And this, I think, is going to be question number two. Question number one being, how do you give the notice? Question number two being, what's actually going to be negotiated? And like many other people, I think, when I first started to think about Brexit and what, you know, what the process would involve, I thought that it would be a question of not just an exit agreement that deals with the practicality of leaving, but also something about trade. After all, we've been part of the union for 40 plus years, and you would expect, as you know, there's a lot of trade between us and the other member states of the union, that if you left, the treaty would provide something about trade. But what the article says is really only it's very limited, because it basically says that we're going to be negotiating and concluding an agreement setting out the withdrawal arrangements, which are the practicalities of leaving, taking account of the framework for the future relationship together, which is not the same as saying, and there'll also be a trade agreement. And the Commission came out, the Commissioner for Trade came out very quickly after the vote and said there won't be any free trade agreement until the UK has left. And then other people said, well, then in that case, what's the meaning of Article 50 when it talks about taking account of the framework for the future relationship together? And of course, it doesn't say who decides what the framework for the future relationship together will be. I think many people think that there may be some interim provisions possible to put into the withdrawal agreement, but largely we're looking actually at a position that the Commissioner for Trade stated after the vote, namely the free trade agreement will probably, by and large, have to follow. There's an important difference between the withdrawal agreement and a future free trade agreement, and it's this. The withdrawal agreement only needs to be agreed by a qualified majority of the Council, which is the Member States, and a simple majority, i.e. 51%, of the European Parliament. A trade agreement needs a simple majority of the European Parliament, but it actually needs unanimous consent and ratification by all EU Member States. And I think this does explain why there haven't been that many free trade agreements negotiated by the Union. And I'm sure, you know, people who felt we were better off out of the Union, this is one of the big criticisms of the Union, that, you know, that one Member State can hold everything up. And it's quite clear from what Mrs. May has said, that she hopes that we will get out of these negotiations, that actually the ability to negotiate free trade agreements is a very important plus, if you like, from leaving. So in terms of what the UK government is seeking from the EU, I learnt a lot from Mrs. May's speeches, and I think I have now a rough idea of what it is that we're going to be asking for. It would appear that we are going to be looking for a bespoke free trade deal, covering free trade in goods and services to the greatest extent that it can be achieved, with the UK free to negotiate its own free trade agreements, which means that we won't be staying in the customs union. We've been in a customs union for 42 years. There have been no tariff barriers at borders. Goods haven't been stopped as they cross borders. One of the things that goes with that, being in a customs union, is you give up exclusively to the union the ability to negotiate free trade deals. So that now we're leaving, one of the consequences of that is that until we've left, we can't actually conclude any free trade deals of our own, and there is an argument about how much negotiation we can get involved in leading to a free trade deal that we might conclude once we've left. So it's quite clear that the position is to try to obtain our own free trade agreements and therefore to come out of the customs union. The other thing that is going to be on the table is the ability for British companies to trade freely with and operate in the single market, with the ability of European businesses to do the same in the UK. The ability for the UK to decide for itself how it controls immigration, protection of the rights of UK citizens living in the EU, no jurisdiction for EU courts in the UK, and we will not be adopting either the Norway model, where Norway, although not a member of the Union, is a member of the European Economic Area, and it, as a member of the European Economic Area, actually accepts all EU law apart from that which relates to agriculture and fisheries, pays a pretty substantial contribution to the EU budget in exchange for full access to the internal market. It accepts all those laws. It's also the ninth biggest contributor to the EU budget. And, of course, the other thing it has to accept is the four fundamental freedoms, including free movement of people. So it's quite clear we will not be adopting the Norway model. We also, it would seem, are not proposing to adopt the Swiss model. And the Swiss model is where the Swiss are outside the Union, they're not members of the EEA, but they did decide that they actually did want access to the internal market, and so they have negotiated product by product, service by service, access to that market, but it has entailed accepting free movement of employed people. And they have negotiated nearly 100 separate bilateral agreements between the Union and Switzerland, but they've also had a referendum in which they rejected free movement of people, and so the whole relationship is actually under, as I see it, enormous strain. Furthermore, the Commission has said it's nearly killed us negotiating all these agreements, and we won't be doing that again. However, it's quite important, I think, to understand how the Swiss model was put together, because even if you didn't want to do that across 100 different products and services, you might perhaps be able to do that across a limited number of product and service areas. And so it's quite important to bear in mind that that possibility is potentially there. Then, so on the day we leave, if there's no free trade agreement, really nothing concrete concluded, which means that there are no tariff barriers between us and the rest of the Union, what's going to happen? And the answer that is often given to that is the UK is a member of the World Trade Organization. And so members of the World Trade Organization, I think there are about 164 of them, all agree with each other to offer each other their most favorable tariffs. And so you would think that if we're a member of the WTO, what's the problem? There'll be some tariffs there. Other people have to offer us their best tariffs. We have to offer them our best tariffs, so we can just use that. But unfortunately, it doesn't quite work like that, because although we are members of the WTO, any tariffs that we have at the moment in our capacity as WTO members have been negotiated in, on the basis that we were part of the EU. And so when these tariffs are negotiated, often quotas of product are involved, as you might imagine. You know, it's this tariff provided the imports don't exceed this amount or whatever it may be. And therefore, there is no immediately available set of tariffs. Most people think, who are trade law experts — I'm not particularly a trade law expert, but most people think, who are trade law experts, that actually you might be able to use a sort of rectification process whereby you ask all the other members of the WTO to accept that the EU tariffs would apply to the UK. Remains to be seen whether that will work. So then lastly, law. What's going to happen to all that EU law? What's going to happen in Wales to all that EU law? And at the moment, nothing changes until we leave. If new laws come out, the obligations of the UK under its international treaty obligations are to comply with them. However, virtually no EU law is coming out at the moment. And the idea put forward at the conference, as I understand it, is that there will be a Great Repeal Act. And this will repeal the European Communities Act 1972, which introduced European Community law, European Union law, into our national legal order. And it will also save all existing EU law, but in its quality as it will become domestic law. So there'll be a repeal, and anything that is not saved will be repealed, but actually everything that has been passed as secondary legislation under the European Communities Act will be saved. So then that brings into question what happens in the context of devolution. And I'm only going to give a high-level picture here, because Jo is so much better qualified to talk about this than I am. I'm sure she will. But basically, as I understand it, Wales is responsible for transposing and implementing EU law within 20 areas of devolved competence and therefore has been doing that. Wales therefore has a direct interest in influencing and shaping relevant EU policy and legislative proposals within those areas. So what will Wales's influence be on Brexit negotiations, first of all? And the answer to that would appear to be it's going to be consultation only. The government will consult and work with the devolved administrations for Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland. So what's going to happen to all that law that the Welsh government has introduced by one method or another when under the Great Repeal Act? And it seems to me that it will all be repealed and then it will all be saved. And I did have a question, which Joe's going to try and answer, I'm sure, how that works, if that's actually by an act of the UK Parliament. Then, after that, once it's all been saved, what will happen to that EU law which applies in Wales, which is particularly the subject of the competences of the Welsh Government and the Welsh Assembly? And the answer that I put to that was it will be up to Wales to decide what to keep, how to keep it, whether to repeal it, whether to amend it, in the light, presumably, of whatever are the outcomes of the negotiations in Brussels. Because if, for example, there are some sectors, I mean, take the financial services sector for one, where actually some kind of deal is struck and there continues to be passporting rights and the kind of full access to the internal market, which goes with complying with EU law, if there's some deal struck on that, how will that work in the context of law that has been saved? Will it be a question for the Welsh Government to decide what of that law they save, or will the UK Government direct that, and how will it all work? One other comment to make about Wales specifically is that investments in Wales from EU funds amount at the moment, as I understand it, to about 2.7 billion. Question as to what, if anything, will replace that funding. According to the Welsh Secretary, Wales will get its fair share of funding, but not at the same level as before. And I'm sure, again, there are people on the platform who are going to be able to comment on the position in relation to funding in Wales in the future much better than I can. And at that point, I'm going to hand back to Catherine.